In a day when the West is utterly swamped, inundated, and marinated in political correctness, we could not more desperately use an antidote as our very lives hang in the balance. Is Islam the religion of peace, as the president reminds us ad nauseum? Or is the greatest religious driver of oppression, strife, and war the world has ever seen? Residents of the Middle East know the answer to this by instinct. We are now being assured that if we only had better gun laws, we'd be safe from all harm. But what kind of gun laws do they have in the Middle East, and whatever other rights do they have? And have their relentless tyrannies produced a safe and healthy society? The question answers themselves as we watch day after day them blowing themselves into bits on big screen TVs while they quibble over disagreements large and small. Before we hand over the rest of our Bill of Rights to another mindlessly liberal fanatical leader promising safety, health, and prosperity in return, let's make sure we ask ourselves the difficult question, what if giving up the Second Amendment backfires? Where would we then turn? Good morning. It's 6:07 and it is the 16th. And I think we've got some very serious questions to answer here. There is a real drive now to get rid of the Second Amendment and to blame all of the problems on access to legal access to guns. But, you know, let me ask you this. Do they have any problem killing each other in the Middle East? And do you really think that they have gun rights? Do you think you can carry a pistol through the streets of Baghdad or Riyadh or any of these great cities in the Middle East? I know there's a lot of guns over there, but there's also a lot of explosives. And so what are you going to do to get rid of all the explosives that could be used over here? I mean, I just think that it's a very obvious thing that what we're dealing with is light years beyond getting rid of the Second Amendment, and that what we really need is to reload and rethink about what is going to best meet our needs of making safe each individual. Do you really believe that, do you really think that it's possible that by simply just getting rid of our weapons that we are going to become safer? I mean, it's a crazy idea, I think. It's too late, number one. There's too many weapons out there, 5, 2, 3, 14, 50. But, you know, beyond that, there is just, you know, I mean, these people are over here now. And, you know, the leader of the CIA or the FBI, James Comey, said it's like looking for a needle in the haystack. And so, and I agree with that, but here's the thing. We've got an opportunity. We've got an opportunity to become better prepared for what's these people around us. I think that if we liberalized the gun laws, in other words, made it easier to carry, then it's going to make life a lot safer. And, you know, if you've got a gun on your hip or under your, in your armpit or wherever, that's an opportunity to defend yourself. If you're in a small bar with 300 people in it, and a lot of them drunk or using drugs or whatever, I'm just assuming, going on over there, I think that that's a situation where you need to be able to defend yourself. This idea that you can't have a gun on you because you might get in an argument and then you lose your head and shoot somebody is absurd. The people that need to be kept away from guns are criminals. criminals by definition break the law. Ergo, if you pass stringent gun laws, the people you're going to keep guns from is law-abiding citizens. Here's FBI Director Comey looking for needles in a nationwide haystack from Fox News 3 days ago.
Became aware of him in May of 2013.
He talking about the Orlando shooter.
He was working as a contract security.
Teaching is Islam is that it's the perfect system. You know, Islam actually teaches that in a natural state, all human beings believe in the Islamic God, that it is the perversion of society that takes people away from that. They have a lot of extremely radical ideas, you know?
Yeah, but you know who made these radical ideas? It's their leaders. It's not the religion itself. You know, the religion itself has two ways. They have the calm Islamic people that are very nice people,
yeah.
And there's the ones that the leaders, or somebody like me, come and claim that I'm taking over, then I write my own rules, and that's how they make the Sharia law and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And they enforce it strictly. And, you know, all these liberals who love everything, that, you know, they don't care, then
they
say
don't
it's
know
okay,
anything.
They come and,
Edward, you know,
first,
Edward, one
you
thing
know,
about
Islam is the enemy of liberalism.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
so they
I know.
Have to be
I know.
Very careful,
I know. Listen, liberal. Edward,
target.
Edward, you know, these people who are so shocked that the gays were killed, if the ISIS or any other group that believes in Wahhabism or the fundamentalist principles that are found in the Sharia and in the Quran, if these people could get into power, the first people they would go after is liberals and gays,
yes,
and all of these,
yes,
you know, feminists and everything. It's crazy. And these are the individuals that are fighting to protect Islam in America and help it establish itself.
Yeah, that's my message to them. You know, all you need to do is go to live in an Islamic country just for 1 week and try to pick on the months where they have like Ramadan and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like the Ramadan is the fasting,
yeah,
time for 30 days.
Yeah.
And these are the times when they become even more violent.
Yeah.
Not all of them, again, not everybody is the same. The ones that are fanatic and the ones who go by the rules. And if you don't follow the rules, they attack you. And they justify that with their religion.
Yeah.
So there's no punishment.
Yeah. But yeah. And,
so
and well, people don't understand also how commonly accepted in Muslim countries is mob violence, is this idea of instant justice. You know, somebody does something and they want the police to move back so that they can go in and kill the person, you know?
Yeah. Well, even the police cannot intervene. If they see them, you know, let's say if a Christian or some outsider is, you know, they're visiting a Muslim country and they wear, let's say, clothes that is offensive to their religion, they can attack you right there in the street and, you know,
right,
stone you to death or beat you up, and the police is even afraid to intervene,
yeah,
because even if they feel sorry or they try to protect you, they'll attack them,
yeah,
for coming to your rescue.
Yeah.
So everybody's scared, so they back off and they just you know, they don't know what they're getting into. And, you know, I got other news for you. They have no respect for women. So we fought all these years to bring freedom and for the, you know, women's rights. All this is going to, if they gain more power in this country, all this is going to go away because they don't believe in women's rights.
Right.
They don't, you know, they have another thing about
Edward,
their religion. It's called Sita. You know what? Have you ever heard of the word Sita?
How do you
that
spell
means,
it?
Well, Sita means any man that at any age, you know, that when they have money and power,
yeah,
they can have any girls at any age, you
yeah
know,
well,
and the families
all right
are willing
Edward
to go along because
okay
they have that
Edward
in their country.
Edward,
so
I'm sorry. Please keep going, but I got to get off the phone here real quick here. I've got to take a break.
Sure. Okay.
Thanks for the call.
You bet.
All right. Okay, folks. So that's somebody Edward has lived over there, and he knows what it's like. 738. He had mentioned something. You can have any girl at any age. Okay, so there's arranged marriage in classical traditional Islam. there is no dating because a man and a woman who are not related to one another cannot spend time together. It is assumed if they do that the woman has slept with the man. If there's an arranged marriage, a person might arrange a marriage, and a man, a grown man, might arrange for a marriage with a child. Now, that child might move into his house with him, at which time he would then raise him as if the child were his own child, but the child would be raised for him to eventually have sex with and marry. Now, they're not supposed to touch the women or have consummate sexual relations until the girl has gone through puberty, but they are allowed to do what we would consider to be molestation to these children, to the girls, believe it or not. And one of the things is called thighing. Now, Muhammad married a young girl when she was 5 or 6 or 7, depending. And this is from Bukhari. And then he consummate the relationship at the oldest at the age of 9. So certainly before she reached puberty. So anyway, 739, 740 on the button. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450 and 805-618. We'll be right back. And we're talking today a little bit about the reality of Islam, not the mirage. All right, guys, here's just a few clips from the current scene. Here's our president. Our president is very, very angry at Donald Trump. Check it out.
For a while now, the main contribution of some of my friends on the other side of the aisle have made in the fight against ISIL is to criticize this administration and me for not using the phrase radical Islam. That's the key, they tell us. We can't beat ISIL unless we call them radical Islamists. What exactly would using this label accomplish? What exactly would it change? Would it make ISIL less committed to trying to kill Americans? Would it bring in more allies? Is there a military strategy that is served by this? The answer is none of the above. Calling a threat by a different name does not make it go away. This is a political distraction.
That doesn't even make sense, does it? I mean, you know, don't call this disease cancer, because if you do, then you're going to scare the person who's been diagnosed and it'll make it harder for them to survive. I mean, the president is really great at coming up with arguments that don't have any substance. And the fact of the matter is that the president has a purpose in not ever calling radical Islam for whatever reason. He thinks that it's, I think there's two things. Number one, he thinks it protects America. But another one is he has sympathy for what he considers to be the real Islam. Now, here's a little bit from David Gergen on this debate between Trump, Obama on calling the attackers radical Muslims.
True anger.
Absolute disdain for Donald Trump and everything he represents.
And the Gergen is talking about Obama's view of Trump.
Great fear on the president's part that Donald Trump could actually succeed and he'll do everything in his power to prevent that from happening. I must say on the substance, I think you have to distinguish between two things. And that is the ban on all Muslims that Trump has been calling for. versus using the term radical Islam. On the first, I think the president is doing very well on that issue. I think he's got the upper hand on that issue. A lot of Americans oppose, yes, a lot of Americans don't like the ban. They think it's a bad idea. Importantly, high-ranking Republicans who are very, very important to him right now are opposed to this ban. Paul Ryan has made it repeatedly clear and said so again today. And Trump face a rebellion before the convention on the, among members of Congress. On the second point, the radical Islam, if I may be permitted, just a quick story. Back in the early 1980s, President Reagan was trying to decide whether to call the Soviet Union an evil empire. I was among those who urged him not to do that on his staff. Thought it was wrong. I thought it was upset the Soviets. I think in retrospect, I was wrong. He used the term. I think it worked well. Tony Dolan, who was a speechwriter, was the one who persuaded him. I think Tony had the better argument, and that is rhetorically confronting, having plain-spoken truth about what you're facing helps to clarify and helps to strengthen your hand.
All right. Now, here's a little bit of analysis on what Obama's up to when he never mentions radical Islam and then gets up in very angry, throws a tantrum at somebody who is criticizing him. The president is very thin-skinned. He just doesn't have a lot of game when it comes to defending himself and his ideas.
The fact that the president goes way out of his way for 7.5 years to avoid the phrase that is obviously the most descriptive of the enemy, radical Islam, means he's doing it for a purpose. He pretends and says, well, if it's a magical phrase, people who are arguing against him are saying, I think the president said, calling it a threat by a different name doesn't make it go away. Of course it doesn't. Nobody implies it does. But deliberately calling it by something meaningless, violent extremism is a completely empty phrase. No one has ever strapped on a suicide vest in the name of extremism. Nobody dies in the name of extremism. Obama is deliberately trying to deny or to hide or to disguise the connection between all of these disparate acts and groups. And if you want to mobilize a country behind you, you need to tell them who the enemy is, why it's doing what it is. FDR did not say the day after Pearl Harbor, yesterday, a day which will live in infamy, we were attacked by the violent extremists.
All right, so I think that's pretty well made. We'll take a break here, 749 AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE, 523-1450 and 805-61802. Text. We'll be right back to finish up on Islam. Hey, it's Kelly.
Okay, that little blurb that Obama said.
What's that?
The little blurb that you played that Obama stated?
Yeah.
This coming from a man who called himself Barry Sotelo during college.
Yeah, he says.
He knows a name is everything. He knows the value of that.
Yeah.
Okay, later.
Thanks, man. All right, so here's a I'm going to try to squeeze in two conversations here. One about the whistleblowers that they're deleting Muslim records at Department of Homeland Security. And if they hadn't deleted those records, maybe they would have stopped this guy before he killed all the gays. And this is off of Sean Hannity.
Exposes the government's submission to jihad. Former DHS employee Philip Haney. Philip, now you started working for DHS in what, 2003, correct?
Yes, I was a founding member of DHS.
And part of your job is you were looking for terror ties. For example, you would identify people with terror links. In the early 2000s, you were profiling people with links to all of these terror groups. That was your job, right?
Yes, we were connecting the dots. We were focusing on individuals and organizations, networks across both United States and with affiliations in foreign countries.
Then 6 years into your tenure in 2009, you were ordered to scrub the records of Muslims with these terror ties by our government. Who told you to do that?
I was directed from DHS headquarters. It's important to keep in mind that that was 1 year after the November 2008 Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terror trial in American history, that irrefutably proved that these individuals from the Muslim Brotherhood front groups were in direct financial support of Hamas.
And that's, so that's the trial where Kerr was named as an unindicted co-conspirator.
Remember one thing, the group that took over Egypt was a tentacle of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the president flipped out when they when the army removed him from office. I've never seen anything like it.
Not mistaken.
As along with Islamic Society of North America and the North American Islamic Trust, three major groups.
Okay, so you were doing your job identifying individuals. You built up a computer database. Obama becomes president. You are literally ordered to scrub the names of Muslims with terror ties that you had worked so hard to find. You believe you could have stopped what happened in Orlando and San Bernardino had you not been ordered by Obama's DHS to do this. Is that true?
Well, that was the first, what I call the first great purge. That was in 2009 with more than 800 records. The case that I'm referring to about stopping the San Bernardino and now related to the Orlando was 3 years later in 2012. It was a larger case called the Tablighi Jamaat Initiative. And it was another network separate from, but related to in some ways, the Muslim Brotherhood network that we just talked about.
So in the case of San Bernardino, it was Saeed Farouk and his wife. You had identified that mosque as a place where you believe we should have been paying attention to, correct?
There's an entire network of those kind of mosques across the United States. And I found out a couple of days ago that the mosque in Fort Pierce is also related to the same network.
Let me ask you bluntly, could San Bernardino, but you were doing this great work, and I applaud you for what you have done. You were told to scrub, literally, the records of Muslims with terror ties. You had to do your job or you'd be fired. Do you believe in your heart that the information you had gathered, if you had kept that information, you might have been able to prevent the terrorist attacks in both San Bernardino and Orlando?
Well, to clarify, I wasn't told to scrub. My agency deleted them themselves. But yes, I believe I have a plausible premise that we could have stopped it by two major ways. Either Saeed Farouk would have been put on the no-fly list and not allowed to travel, or his pending fiance would have been denied a visa because of his affiliation with an organization with plausible ties to terrorism. That's at least two different ways.
Can I repeat this?
All right. So that order came from the top. Those orders came from the president, obviously. Now, here's a little bit on Hillary's plan to bring in more Muslims.
And they're plotting things right now, and we're letting more in. Hillary Clinton's letting everybody in. She has a 550% increase over Obama. She wants to let that many more people in from Syria and from various places. Now, I just think it's insane because we don't know what's going on. We have no control over it. But you have people right now, Sean, worse, in my opinion, worse and maybe with bigger minds than this savage that just got killed. So I mean, the concept of allowing more people in when you know that many of them are going to have problems and going to cause trouble is incredible.
When you call for a temporary ban on refugees, people coming from countries, I'm sure you know that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, the FBI Director Comey, the Assistant FBI Director Steinbeck, the House Homeland Security Committee Chairman Mike McCall, Obama's former special envoy to defeat ISIS, General Allen, they all said, and ISIS has said, that they will infiltrate the refugee population. Now, the president insists we take these people in. Hillary's all for it. To me, that's gambling with people's lives, the American people's lives. Why would they ever risk that?
All right. So anyway, tomorrow we're going to have on the show Jeff Steinborn. He stopped by and we had a little conversation yesterday. He apologized, and we have got him coming on at 7 o'clock, and we do have a call here. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Tom.
Yeah.
They're working real hard right now on getting the terror watch list going. But you know who's going to be on the terror watch list?
Who?
People like you. Because you speak bad about the government.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Tom.
Okay.
Have a good day. All right, folks, we'll take you out here with some music. Have a great day. Thanks for tuning in. AM Las Cruces, 1450 KOBE. Kelly O'Connell, see you back in 22 hours. Ciao.
Sean, on the...
Oops. Oh, we have one more call. Yeah, we just... All right, folks. I know if you want to talk, call in before the show ends. We'll be... See you tomorrow. Hey, it's Kelly.
Hey, Kelly, this is David. I sell the ear candles on the Proud Patriot, all that kind of stuff.
Yes, go ahead, man.
I'm getting a lot of repercussions for calling in like this. Forgive me for not calling in, talking. I love talking with you. There's a lot of stuff going on. I'd like to change my name.